The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Michael Brito. Michael is a digital strategist, published author, TEDx speaker, and adjunct professor with over 20 years of experience helping brands break through the clutter and reach their audience with game-changing content. He has served as executive vice president at Zeno Group, head of social marketing at W2O Group, and senior vice president of social marketing at Edelman Digital. His newest book is called Participation Marketing, Unleashing Employees to Participate and Become Brand Storytellers. Michael Brito, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with this quote from your book. You write, quote, "The general state of the workplace is dismal. More specifically, engagement in the workplace is dismal." So that is a provocative statement. Why? Why is it so dismal?
I mean, that was the point, to be provocative. I mean, there are companies with great cultures. There are companies with high engagement rates. But overall, if you look at the ecosystem today, and living in Silicon Valley, I look at business through the lens of living there, of being around technology companies for the last 25 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say the workplace is dismal, I certainly need to take that with a grain of salt. We have a changing workforce that is coming into the market. Millennials are now the largest and most diverse group that are entering the workforce. They're becoming directors. They're entrepreneurs. They're starting businesses. They're making purchase decisions. And the way that business usually operates is not meeting the needs of today's workforce in terms of work-life balance, in terms of building trust and authenticity and being transparent about business operations.
Yeah, so it's about people. This book is so much about people, and I'm guessing that's exactly because you are in Silicon Valley, a place that is so focused on data, where so much invention is going on, really powerful, great stuff. You have a great statement in here. You say, like most everyone else, I don't relate to logos. I relate to people, and I relate to personal experiences. Talk about the difference between relating to a logo and relating to a personal experience.
Well, I mean, there's always an exception to the rule, right? I'm a huge Mac person. I love Apple. Yes, I relate to the Apple logo more so than probably anybody else on the planet. I love Mac products, and I probably don't know one person out there. However, when you look at outside of that, those outliers, you know, there. To give you a quick example, there are about four or five shops around my house where I could take my clothes to go to dry cleaning, right? Mm-hmm. Within a 1 mile radius, there's five or six. And I've been going to the same woman for the last 20 years because when her and I met 20 years ago, there was just a natural affinity I had towards her. She was a very nice woman from Korea. She was very well spoken. She cared about people. And we established a relationship 20 years ago. And I've been going back ever since and probably spent thousands of dollars throughout the course of my career, taking my wife's clothes, my daughter's clothes, my clothes to her. And it's because of that relationship. And I will never go anywhere else because even if they don't do a great job sometimes when they crease my pants when they're not supposed to,
yeah,
I still go back because there is that personal relationship that her and I have. Her name is Joanne. She's a wonderful woman, very smart. I know her daughter. Her daughter just got, I mean, I kind of know everything about her.
Hmm.
And all of our interactions have only been over the counter, when I'm dropping off my laundry and when I'm picking it up.
So this is interesting because you have this one-on-one relationship, but you also work in a place of scale where it's very hard for everyone to have that kind of relationship. But I think what, with the advent of social media, right, we now have the ability to kind of know our audience sort of writ large in a very powerful way. And it's interesting, you have a term called social listening, which I think is related to that idea of how you know your audience. Do I have that right?
Absolutely.
So talk to us about social listening. What does that mean?
Well, you know, there's a lot of technology platforms out there, and there's been a lot of consolidation. A lot of companies have gone under, have been acquired by large firms like Salesforce and Oracle. And it's software that kind of scours the entire internet. You know, Twitter, blogs, comments on YouTube, Reddit posts, forum posts, news articles, etc. And what it does is it just kind of gives you an understanding of how people perceive your company, how people perceive your, you know, your CEO, how people perceive your products or mm-hmm. a campaign if you launched it. So it's a way to really scale and get a really firm understanding. It's almost like an online focus group, right, where all mm-hmm. these companies like Coca-Cola and Pepsi are spending thousands of dollars, you know, getting 10, 15 people together and asking them questions, and it's very directed questions. This is kind of an unfiltered view at anything you want to know. It's like a Google search, right? You Google anything you want to know about right. anything, and you get results. It's the same thing with social listening. You search for any topic, any name, any product, a series of names, and you can get insights into how people perceive your brand and opportunities to change it and or you know, respond to customers in real time.
This is the thing. So this stuff fascinates me because, and I don't know how much you know about how Second City has created its shows since 1959, but we essentially crowdsource our content. We come to the audience and say, we take a list of like, what are the topics that are on your mind? Who are the people that you want us to talk about? We create improv scenes around this and then craft it in rehearsal and turn it into material. And so like, we're like the analog version of that from late 50s. But what it results in, I think, is a kind of authenticity of content that you don't necessarily get otherwise when you're not co-creating with an audience.
That's a very good point. There's been a lot of times when companies like HP, for example, years ago when they launched their, it was a series of netbooks. Remember the smaller laptops?
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Well, they basically would crowdsource colors of the colors of the type of netbooks that the customers and the audience wanted them to produce. And a lot of companies have done that since then, where they're asking the community, asking the people how they want their operations to change or how they want, you know, to launch a new product, colors, sizes, decorations, etc. And in many cases, like, for example, with Verizon years ago, wanted to institute a $10 a month service fee if you paid your bill online versus sending it via mail. Mm-hmm. And when people online found out about it, there was a huge uproar. Within 24 hours, the CEO of Verizon had came out with a public statement saying, you know what, this is a miscalculation on their part. They are not going to institute this $10 fee. So, a result of social listening is an opportunity for companies of any sizes, small, medium, large, to listen and actually respond and take action.
I was at I was in L.A. this weekend doing a keynote at the Festival of Books that the L.A. Times puts on. And at the end of it, I was taking questions and someone said, what's one of your biggest failures? Because I talk a lot about failure and you do, too. And I said, I'll tell you exactly what it was. I worked for like 3 years to get the rights to the movie Slapshot to put it on stage. And the people I consulted with on this were all people who love the movie. We were going to do it in Canada where they're hockey crazy. What I failed to take into effect is that most of the people who buy tickets to theater are women, and no one wanted to come see that show. It didn't matter how good it was. And this is the problem we get when we take our own counsel and when we don't like really go out and talk to our audiences. We make really terrible decisions and bad products, and this is something that you see still happen all the time.
Well, yeah, and that's the whole point. Really, the point of the book is really to build a layer of engagement that companies mm-hmm. can have with their customers, right? That layer are employees. And employees, and it could be a 10-person startup. It could be a large corporation like IBM with 400,000 employees. Layered kind of approach where you are training and mobilizing and unleashing groups of people The ones that certainly raise their hand and say that they want to, not the people who are outraged or unhappy and, you know, they didn't get the raise or they're unhappy with their manager.
Yeah.
These are people that have a natural affinity towards the brand, who are already social in nature. That in itself is an opportunity to be that layer of feedback to the community, that layer of being able to put content in front of audiences at the right time that is more trusted than if the brand were to do it themselves.
So that's really interesting. So this is a big part of the book. It's the big part of the book is the lowest hanging fruit we have in our business is all our employees. And it's not just about, as you just pointed out right now, it's not just about getting them to amplify your brand. Sure, that's part of it. But like you're saying is, I could have tested that idea through everyone we know, you know, the hundreds and hundreds, but thousands of people who work at Second City, and I probably would have learned a lot more. But we don't think about that. We don't think about beta testing to our own people.
That is correct. And that's a huge mistake, right? Because your people will be honest with you. Your people will tell you if your campaign or your product sucks. You know, assuming that there's an open dialogue, right? There's companies today that operate this in this kind of command and control environment, unfortunately. And so in that situation, you're not going to get honest feedback. But if you have a culture that is supportive, that trusts its leadership, there's open dialogue between the end employee who's the database administrator or the guy at the front desk and the CEO, then you're going to get real feedback. And it's almost like beta testing before you go to market.
Yeah.
You know? So it's a great opportunity for companies to really not just amplify the content, but really build a culture of trust, a culture of transparency, and almost like a newsroom, right? You're in the media, right? You understand how newsrooms operate, and that's exactly how the media, the companies need to think, because there's so much madness in the world. There's so much noise. Attention spans are at an all-time low that it's really difficult to get in front of an audience, even with millions of dollars of paid media, right? So if you can use employees to kind of surround sound your audiences, your potential customers, with content, with stories, with amplified branded content, then all of a sudden you're reaching them into places that you might not be able to reach them directly through the brand.
Right. And side benefit, really important side benefit, is you are going to build happier employees. Retention will go up. Job satisfaction will go up. I think one thing people forget is, like, if you can really focus your attention first on your own employees, all the good customer service will follow that. I think a lot of brands think, well, no, we have to be on the customers first. But if you're cutting out the employees, you might be making a tragic mistake.
Well, here's the beauty of this. Now, I'm a marketer. So when I wrote the first couple chapters of the book are meant to really empower and counsel those who work in HR or internal communications or employee comp. But to me, I'm looking at it beyond that. I want to build a culture of storytellers, because that is really what's going to drive ROI. Now, the end benefit of that, certainly to your point, people who are happy, productive, engaging, they go to work motivated, and typically, me working in the services industry, right, where I have, if my employees are happy, they typically will produce a higher quality of work. And then when my clients receive high quality work, they will typically want to spend more money with our company. So the business benefit of all this, it's not just, having fun and just feeling happy and the warm and fuzzies. There is certainly a business ROI benefit of this, of participation marketing.
Let's talk about storytelling, because obviously big buzzword, a lot of people teach it. Second City offers workshops in storytelling to businesses, all that. What I know in my 30 years of producing at Second City, and I've produced a lot of live theater, a lot of stories, a lot of scenes on stage, is overwhelmingly the best stories are about people's failures and about people's problems. Almost no one wants to hear about your success story. And there's a sense of authenticity that comes with someone's sort of failure story. And you talk about being very sort of, you're very pro failure in this book. You're like, you gotta get out there and take shots and risk. And I think that that's not always a natural pivot for people in business.
And I love to fail, because when I fail, I learn.
Yep.
And the hardest part is when you fail and you don't, right? That is a life lesson, right?
Yeah.
There's going to be so many failures where at some point, hopefully, you sure enough to then say, you know what, I got to stop doing it this way because the end result is this. It's like the definition of insanity, right?
Yep.
So me, and I take that as somebody who's failed a lot in my life, ever since growing up in a very poor town of East San Jose and kind of being successful to where I am today, a lot of failures in my entire life. And so when I look at my teens and I see that they're trying and they fail, we celebrate failure because it's an opportunity to learn, and a lot of times you learn more quickly and exponentially through a failure than you would directly through a success on your first time.
And I think it's important to recognize that human beings have a natural inclination to veer away from failure. It's scary. It's, you know, we're worried about our job security. And so it is very much up to the leaders in business to send these sort of belonging cues and design situations in which you can be pro-failure. I've talked about this in my book, where Basecamp does like every year a celebration of the worst idea or the worst product that didn't work. And they all laugh about it and celebrate it. And that just takes the steam out of it. So we do a thing, I've talked about this before, when creating Second City shows, is we'll do Taboo Day, where you have to bring in a scene that there's no way we'll allow to be on a Second City stage. And invariably, those scenes get in because they're really good and someone's just taken off the shackles.
Well, you know what? Plus failure, I mean, when I hear a story, I'm intrigued. I mean, that's the whole point of stories, right? At some point in any plot, there's some issue where there's a failure, right? And then the plot or the story, there's a rebound, right? And then you kind of live happily ever after. And so when I look at a story and when I see somebody persevere through failure, to me, I'm more intrigued. Mm-hmm. I'm more engaged. I want to know. I'm listening. I'm not, you know, my ADD isn't kicking in and thinking about what I'm going to do tomorrow. I'm actually listening and watching and waiting to see what happens next. And that's why failure is so important.
So one of the biggest barriers, I believe, to innovation is often success, like past success. And you have a quote in the book that I think speaks towards that. You say, quote, "Expertise in a particular area, though, can actually be a hindrance to innovating for that area." Unpack that a bit for us.
I'm glad you brought that up. No one has ever asked me about that. Because when you have so many successes in life, and there are people that just have never really failed. They've been kind of lucky. Maybe lucky is not the right word, but they've been successful, and they may have encountered a few stumbling blocks, but never really have encountered hardship or failure. And the problem with that is that they're not open to listening to other people's perspectives and kind of building the collaborative environment where you are, you know, building off other people's past experiences. So people who don't fail are often the ones that don't like to innovate or don't innovate faster, because what they think is that what they're doing is right, and always right, because historically they have been right.
Right.
And even though they may not be right, or this may not be the right color or the right model or the right technology stack, they think it is because they've never failed. But the people who are surrounding him or her looking in at the situation often have much better ideas because they tried this before and they failed. And the problem is that those who have never failed are less likely to listen to feedback and then implement feedback when it's given.
There's tons of data and science around this that the more powerful you are, the more wealthy you are, the less you see and the less people speak truth to you. I certainly have seen that in my career. And I wonder for you, having been a leader, and I've been a leader, and I was successful for a long while, and I kind of had to blow myself up a couple different times to get to that sort of discomfort area where I could sort of re-innovate. Is that something that you experienced in your career?
I mean, I have, and you know, it's you know, to the point where, and you say blow up, and kind of, you know, for me, it's I'm very hard on myself, you know, and when things don't pan out the way that I want them to, I, you know, sometimes I'm a little bit more harsh than I am on myself than others appear to be me or I am to others, because I have an expectation for myself to be to act a certain way, to provide value a certain way, and when I don't feel that I've reached that level, you know, I'm kind of down in the dump. And honestly, sometimes I pout. Sometimes I'm kind of, you know, depressed in terms of, you know, not wanting to go do things, you know, all the time with my family. But, you know, there's times when, you know, that sulking then becomes motivation to do better. Because sulking is important, and feeling sorry for yourself, it's a good process to go through, right? Because you don't want to spend weeks and weeks and weeks doing it. But a day of reflection, a couple of days, maybe a weekend of reflection, just looking at the situation and dwelling on it, for me at least, is that mechanism that then turns it around and makes me push 100,000 times harder.
We have a phrase in improvisation that you have to make mistakes work for you. And I found a quote from your book where you say, though the instinct for leadership is to lay low during times of challenge and strife, they can actually work really well for the introduction of new processes and tasks. So I know what I mean when I say make mistakes work for you, that they can often sort of reveal opportunities. Is that a similar sentiment that what you're talking about is when stuff gets really thorny and difficult, often that's the opportunity you have to try something kind of radical and new?
Well, look at companies like Uber, right? Yeah. Look what they've been going through the last couple of years.
Yeah.
There's just been this dismantling of leadership, and even Google's going through some of it with certain leaders getting in trouble for things that they've said and for their behaviors. And the smart companies, Southwest is a great example. Right, we just saw it last week. Right, Southwest had an issue where a woman she died on a flight, and the way they handled that to me was pristine. I mean it was a crisis communications issue.
Yeah,
but it helped the bit. I mean, from what I understand, their stock price skyrocketed after that because they confronted the issue and they're innovating and. It didn't. I mean, it certainly helped that it was a woman who was the pilot, and she was in the military at one point. So that was kind of helped kind of alleviate a lot of discontentment at the beginning. But companies who do that and are in the midst of challenges and stock price falling or revenue declining or leadership malfunctions, the ones that are actually building processes. And here's the thing, though, Kelly, that people like you and I, when we see a company who is in the midst of chaos and they do something, you and I and people, I think sophisticated people who are, and even non-sophisticated people, but people, smart people, can see when companies are just doing something because of the fact that they're in this mess.
Yeah.
And they're doing it to and they're not authentic about it. Right. So we can spot inauthenticity very easily. So I think the companies that are truly transparent, truly wanting to make that change are the ones that are accepted. And people like you and I mean, we accept apologies and we kind of move on, whereas companies try to hide it and try to manipulate the situation. Those are the ones that fail long term.
Yeah, it never works. How did you like or not like Starbucks' response to the incident in Philadelphia?
That's a great question. I don't know all the details. I mean, I know from a cursory standpoint what happened. I know there's a lot of issues and a lot of talk shows talking about it.
Yeah.
I think they did a great job. The fact that they're shutting down, 8,000 stores, I believe, for training.
Yep.
I think that's important. You know, they probably should have done that before.
Yeah, sure.
Companies should be doing this now, but before so situations like this don't happen. I think that the way they handled it was, again, pristine, just like Southwest. They have a really smart comms team, and I wouldn't have done anything different. What I think this could do is help other companies, especially companies in retail who are dealing with diverse people all the time, to start doing training so that this doesn't happen and to avoid it in the future.
Yeah. So we do a lot of work in the behavioral science community, and there's wide understanding in that community as well as corporate diversity and inclusion officers that there's zero data that diversity training works. And there's many reasons for that. And what I liked about Starbucks was that, yes, okay, we're going to do this action. And I think there's a follow up and I'm expecting it from them, which is we started this now and it doesn't end because it's not so much about, in our work, we're like, look, people are going to say the wrong thing and do the wrong thing. We can't stop them from doing that. But what we can do is figure out how to fix it in the moment or make the pivot in the moment. How do we make it better so you can apologize, you can, not repeat the same mistake, which you said earlier, that's the big thing, right? If you do the same thing wrong again, you got a real serious problem. So I think in the future, as we get more sophisticated and as more sort of science and data driven evidence enters into our workplaces, the people who are not authentic storytellers, the people who don't allow their flaws to be seen and then figure out the strength of a strong apology, if they can't do that, I don't think they survive.
I agree with you 100%, especially in the age of social media, right, where everything is public, everybody's sharing. I mean, there's also some challenges with that, right, the trolling in that regard. But overall, I think people, companies who are not transparent, eventually they're going to be called out, and either stock price is going to take a hit. Now, they may or may not go out of business. I mean, you know, that's TBD. But there will be this kind of negative halo effect perception of those companies who are really trying to manipulate people and manipulate the situations that they're in.
Okay, so we got a few minutes left, and I am going to ask you for a yes and story, which is how we end the podcast. But there was so much stuff in this book that I kept writing down and sharing with colleagues that I want to just like throw some stuff at you that you say about and get, quickly sort of get your viewpoint on. You write, quote, "No one wants more emails." I mean, amen, first of all, but I want you to, why does no one want any more emails?
I looked at my daughter's iPhone the other day. She's 16. She has 10,000 emails in that little icon on her iPhone.
Oh, no.
It drove me nuts.
And no.
What's going on? She's like, well, I don't read my emails. If they want to get a hold of me, they'll snap at me or they'll send me a message on Instagram or they'll text me. And that's why people don't want emails. Today's generation they don't like PCs. They don't like Mac. They don't like computers. They like that little handheld device, iPhone, Android, whatever. And that's the reason why people don't want email. Now, there's still people, obviously, like you and I, that probably prefer email. I still prefer sending and receiving on my laptop.
Yeah, me too.
Not a good texter. But, you know, 10 years from now, the majority of our workforce, you know, the IT departments are probably not going to be handing out laptops. So we just have to be cognizant of the way people are communicating, especially the millennial, the young millennial group that are coming into the workforce, and that next generational group of Gen Z.
I mean, it is so true. I've got a 20-year-old and a 15-year-old. Neither of them is their preferred communication is email.
And my daughter hates it. I say, did you get my email? I sent her an email about her grades or something.
Mm-hmm.
And she never got it. She never responded. Oh, sorry, let me go check that.
Yep. Okay. You also write in here, and our head of marketing, I sent this to, and I will tell you her response after I read the quote. Well, you say 60-70% of all content created by B2B marketing teams is never touched by sales. That seems crazy.
It's a huge problem. And there's a few reasons why. Silos, right? Marketing doesn't talk to sales, doesn't talk to PR, doesn't talk to customer support. Or marketing is just producing lousy content that sales team does not even want to use.
Mm-hmm.
So when you think about the audience, think about the buyer, think about their behavior, and as a marketing team, create content that drives value, right, in the form of blog posts, white papers, ebooks, short-form videos, not spec sheets, but, you know, promotional content. This is content that has to help your buyers solve problems or be utility, or be some type of resource to solve a technology issue. That sales will jump on that, and sales will be more than happy. It's called social selling, right?
Yeah.
More than happy to take that content, package it up their own way, and send it to their prospect or share it on LinkedIn. And that's what really drives business up. And that's what's going to ultimately drive leads.
Marilyn at Second City, when I sent her that quote, she's like, I think it's 95% in our case. And literally at the end of this was actually this week on Monday on a call with the sales team. And she was on the phone. She said, listen, we have all this stuff for you guys. Can next week we just talk about whether you want to use it, can't use it, don't know how to use it, want something different, because I will do that. But we have to sort of get on the same page. And I'm like, it's amazing that we're having this conversation. One more question before I ask for your yes and story. Today's podcast, because we launch every Tuesday and we're taping this on a Tuesday, is with Charlene Nemeth, who's a Berkeley professor who wrote a book called In Defense of Troublemakers. And it's basically the evidence-based science around dissent and how dissenters make us think more creatively, and we have more divergent thinking. Is that what you mean when you say the words embrace the black sheep?
Oh, 100%. Okay. But I prefer the way that she put it more than what I did. those in the company who are black sheep, the rebels, right? Those who are kind of the ones who are always speaking up, and the kind of, you know, when they say something, other people roll their eyes. A lot of times, those are people who have the best ideas, and the only way that they can get their ideas across is by being sarcastic, is by being rebellious, is by interrupting people, is by being that guy or girl who's always reply all to email, or lifting their hand up during a company meeting and asking those tough questions. Those are people that we must embrace. A lot of times they're the ones with the best ideas.
Yeah, and I think it's not taking care of the assholes so much as it is the taking care of the outlier. So we had this actor, Paul Jurowitz, at Second City. He was on the main stage, brilliant performer. And every time there were all company emails, he would always choose to then respond to the entire company a lot of personal information about himself. He'd be reacting to things that he had nothing to do with. And for some people, they got really upset about it. To me, it humanized every corporate communication we had, and it, like, we're in the comedy business, let the comedian come and comment on this. We might even discover something. So I think that that's really important, is that it's not about excusing bad behavior, but it's allowing for, let's say, eccentric behavior or alternative behavior.
That is a very great point. By the way, I'm looking at your Twitter profile. You're in Chicago.
Yeah.
I'm in Chicago as we speak. I just flew in today.
Ah.
So maybe I'll run into you downtown somewhere.
We might. Stranger things have happened. All right. So we ask every guest at the end of the podcast to tell us a yes and story. So this is an improv principle, right? Which is, if you have groups of people making something out of nothing, they get nowhere by saying no. And they can't just say yes. They have to affirm and contribute, say yes and, in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have an experience in your life where you would normally have said no, but instead you said yes and.
Yes, I will. I have. I have several ones, and I want to share one really quickly. But before I do, I can provide a little context.
Yeah.
So growing up, I was a rebel. I was the black sheep. I was a single. I was in a single family home. My mom raised me. I was a latchkey kid. I was rebellious in school. I was rebellious at soccer practice. I was rebellious with my mom. I hated process. I hated chores. I talked back. I was one of those kids that you get annoyed when you walk by at the mall.
Yeah.
Kind of having a little attitude. That was me. I had an opportunity when I was 18 years old. I barely graduated from high school. In fact, I didn't graduate from high school. I graduated from adult education, which is an equivalent to a diploma. And I had an opportunity to do something interesting. I had no goals. I had no vision. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was 18. I was still living at home. My mom was about to start charging me rent. So I had an opportunity to join the military. Now, I knew at that point that I was going to have to do a lot of processes. I couldn't say no. I had to say yes on everything. And when I looked at my life and reflected back, I would have said no in an instant for the first 8 years of my life. I said yes. And it was the best thing I've ever done.
Wow.
It taught me how to be accountable for my decisions. It taught me how to step up and be a man and be responsible. And honestly, if I would have never been to the military or went to the military, I probably wouldn't have the career I have today. They pay for college. They taught me how to be accountable. And here I am 20 plus years later on this great podcast with you talking about it. So that's my story.
That's an awesome story. And it's so interesting because I didn't know about your background in terms of the military. But I think this is, again, it's counterintuitive for people, because they would think entering military, you're going to become a drone. You're just going to be taking, but no, what you found was the discipline to then unleash this level of creativity, which can often be very chaotic. And I think that, people who are on the ground in the military are often very good improvisers, because they have to rely on their fellow man. They have to react in a split second. And that there's a high level of improvisation that happens inside the military, from my understanding.
Actually, that's very accurate. I've never thought of it that way. And yes, it's very true. It has unleashed a sense of creativity. It didn't happen overnight. It was a process of 20 plus years going to college and getting married and having a family and going through different work environments. But I do attribute the foundation of innovation and discipline and being driven and proud back to my military.
The book is called Participation Marketing. It's really, really good. If you're in this field, go get it. Michael Brito, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Jay. I really appreciate it.
I've been working.
broken.